Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's session on practical learnings in applying GBM, GLM, and traditional analysis in modeling life insurance claims and lapses. My name is Ziming Yu, and it's my pleasure to chair today's session. So we're joined by two fantastic presenters today. Timothy Lam currently serves as a research and analytics actuary at Genry. In his role, Tim supports actuarial and operational research projects across offices in Canada, the UK, South Africa, and Australia. Beyond his actuarial expertise, Tim enjoys basketball refereeing and spends much of the season officiating games across the state. Jin Cui is a qualified actuary with extensive experience in life insurance and data science, and currently holds the role of senior manager of data science at TAL. Jin is passionate about integrating data science and statistical methodologies to solve complex business problems and drive innovation, particularly within the life insurance sector. So we'll begin with a 35-minute presentation by Tim and Jin, and followed by a 10-minute Q&A. Before we start, a few quick reminders. So please ensure your phones are set to silent, and questions can be submitted to the Q&A feature on the Summit HQ app. Please type the question directly into the app and I'll address them during the Q&A segment. And now, without further ado, please join me in warmly welcoming Timothy Lam and Jin Cui.
I want to stand here because I've come to realize if I stand on that side, no one can see me who's sitting in the front row. So firstly, acknowledge my country. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land and waters where we live and work, travel and trade. We pay our respect to the members of those communities, elders past and present, and recognize and celebrate the continuing custodianship and culture. And of course, we stand on the land of Gadigal. So what Jin and I will be talking about today, we'll go through introduction and context, and then I'll also go through morbidity analysis, which is what I worked on. Jin will then go and talk about the lapse analysis that he has worked on, and then summarize, and then we'll go through a summary, and then we'll have questions and comments. Yes, we welcome comments. So if you don't have questions, but you have comments, you're very welcome to make comments. So a bit of introduction, and we start with motivation. We wanted to do this presentations because we've come to find that GLM applications in life insurance has become more and more common. All right, and that's a reflection of the new fellows now having the analytics skill set, which is great. But also increased data that is available. On the flip side, AI, in particular, generative AI is front of mind for everyone. It wasn't actually that long ago, at the beginning of my career, when everyone was talking about big data. And actually, most of our work is about insights generation. So while Gen AI is important, we felt that analytics, being able to tell stories about data, is also important. And so we were thinking, well, can we do something together? Can we share our learnings? We might be wrong, but that's okay. Can we create discussions around things beyond GLM? And so it's very important to understand what this presentation is and what this presentation is not. This presentation is about Jin and I sharing our learnings from applying three different methods in two distinct analyses. It is to encourage discussion. What this isn't is not insight generation on a model data. The two data sets that we've used have gone through insights generation presentations. It is not a three-star presentation. It's a two-star presentation. So this is not a deep dive into the technical methodology, which we're very happy to have three-star questions and we'll answer them. But if you're expecting a lot of formulas, this is not one of them. This is actually trying to help everyone compare and contrast the modeling techniques on a data set that we are hopefully familiar with. I mean, to address the elephant in the room, we're not claiming that GBM is the best analysis. Just put it out there first. Because, well, you will find out. Because there are different considerations. So in general, the classes of models explored, and on the right there, if you're presenting at the summit, this is actually the stock image that the Institute provided, and I thought it was actually very useful, because this is what we've explored. I'm going to do a quick survey. Who has done traditional analysis, experience analysis before? I'm hoping it's everyone, almost everyone. Keep your hand up if you've used GOM. And then keep your hand up if you've used GBM. Yeah, so a mix. But what's interesting is I didn't actually define what traditional analysis is, and people have put their hand up. So I think we have a mutual understanding of what traditional analysis is. Could be. You will actually, we should have done a presentation together, because I'm going to skip to this in a moment, and you will see it is one factor. But we'll get to there in a moment. GLM, for those who are more technical, both of us have used regularize, and we did cross-validation. GBM, we went grid search and cross-validated. We're not going to go into those kind of details. Just know that we've done what we're meant to do to reduce overfitting. In terms of the considerations, we generally consider things in three categories. Accuracy, so how close are the predicted values to the actual values. We consider interpretability, how easy is it to explain to people, to our stakeholders. Efficiency is a little bit broad, so it's like time taken to model, time taken to explain, time upstream integration, downstream integration, etc. Now, that's the framework. Jin and I have slightly different interpretation on those items, but broadly, that's the case. Now I'll go through the morbidity analysis. A little bit of context and data. It's actual data from the New Zealand industry study, disability income accident incidents. Hopefully something that you guys are familiar with when it comes to experience analysis data. It's from 2013 to 2019, and we have, or in this case, I have used 2013 to 2018 data to fit, and then 2019 to validate. Trying to simulate an exercise where we are at, say, 31st of December 2018, and what would happen. I've chosen to do a regression analysis or a portfolio analysis. As to why I've done that, you'll find out when Jin speaks. I then find it useful. The first learning for me is, through this analysis, is actually the models fitted and how they relate to each other. I was very lucky early on in my career. In my previous employer, I was given the opportunity to graduate the underlying ADI and AOS tables. And during that exercise, I tried to actually utilize GBM techniques, as you will see if you've read the graduation report. But one of the questions that came up was, how do all these models reconcile to each other? And this is one of the first insights that I've learned that I would like to share with you. So, traditional model. The simplest traditional model is an average adjustment. This is not to say that all actuaries are going to make the same traditional adjustment. We're probably going to make different ones. We're probably going to add some factors here and there in our traditional adjustments. But for the purpose of comparison, I'm defining traditional to be an average adjustment on the expected. Linking to that, to a GOM, it's actually just a traditional model adding more factors. That's the beauty of GOM and defining traditional in such manner. This is actually quite common, and I think it's quite well understood in the industry. The bit that was very interesting for me as well, how do I link this to a regression tree? One split. Basically, regression tree one split is, rather than having age as a continuous variable, let's actually go, it's either below 30 or high and equal to 30. That's two splits. And what I've done as part of my learnings is I fitted a GOM using the same variable, same predictor. So I created an indicator variable that is literally cutting X, that indicates zero if it's less than 30 and one if it's larger than equal to 30. And then I reconciled it. That gave me a lot of comfort when it comes to how to go from GOM to GBM later on, because if I can reconcile this, then I can understand a regression tree with more splits. It's just rather than age smaller than 30 or larger than 30, it could be more cuts. The slides will be provided, so you're welcome. I can send it to you, Iris. And then from many splits, we can then go to a GBM with a lot of, well, so the technical audience is going to tell me many regression trees can be a random forest. But we're not going to technical. In this case, we're using boosting. It is many more regression trees. And this is actually for me, a mental model in how to link traditional analysis to GOM to GBM. And these three are the models that are fitted in the analysis. Hopefully this helps if there are any instances where we need to explain to our stakeholders or we need to understand the different models that have been fitted, how they relate to each other. And so after fitting to the data, we will go and look through accuracy, we will look at interpretability, and we'll look at efficiency. Starting with accuracy, before I go to the next slide, because it has numbers, I just want to tell you what you're going to see first, as opposed to jump to numbers immediately, as we do as actuaries. So if the first column, you're going to see either traditional GOM or GBM, and the second column is more detailed, it's tailored to the audience who wants to know a little bit more detail, but if you don't want to know that much detail, just stick to the first column. It's a traditional GOM and GBM. And the first accuracy measure that I tested was something that is commonly used in the industry. It's the AVE. And this is the result. I had AVP on a training data of 100% across the board. And this is a very key learning for me in the sense that any model that we use, if we're doing an average adjustment, we always get an AVP of 100% or actual versus adjusted expected. And so is that then a good measure when we're doing experience analysis using different model techniques? Well, then I went down a pathway of, okay, what will we use in statistical analysis? Well, usually we'll use mean squared error if it's a linear regression. In a Poisson regression, we'll use Poisson deviance. Now, in here, Poisson deviance is, the theory is that the lower, the better, right? So on the trend, just to explain, I forgot to explain the model. The models, GOM null is traditional. If you've heard me speak before, we love using regularization, lasso regularization in particular. So this is a minimum lambda. This is the one standard error lambda. This is the lambda that I've chosen in between. GBM default is basically the same as GBM 30,000 trees, except I've used 1,000 trees instead. And it's to demonstrate something later down the line. Back to this though, the Poisson deviance train is the Poisson deviance on the training data. So the first 6 years, the Poisson deviance validate is the Poisson deviance on the 2019 AIDA validation data. But back to Poisson deviance, it is something that is quite hard to interpret beyond this. So I'm going to go to the next slide, and this is how I have, I guess, tried to make it easier to interpret. So going back to R squared, in linear regression, R squared is a very, very useful measure. Basically, it allows us to compare the remaining error or the explainability of the fitted model compared to the average error in the data. So to explain this using an example, if the total sum of squares is, say, 100, and the sum of squares of residuals, so the remaining error from the fitted model is 40, then the right-hand side here is 40%. So 1 minus 40% is 60%. It means the model is able to explain 60% of the error in the data. And I went, well, can we change this slightly to pseudo R squared? Now, there are many, many pseudo R squared out there. This is just one that I've defined for the purpose of interpretability. So on the right-hand side, on the top, we have the Poisson deviance of the fitted model. At the bottom, we have the Poisson deviance of the null model, such that if the fitted model is the null model, the fraction is 1. And so therefore, 1 minus 1 is 0. That's basically saying that the null model fits the same as the null model, which by definition is true. And if there's any improvement, then it'll be a positive percentage. If it doesn't improve, then it will be a negative percentage. And after performing that calculation, this is what we see. This is how I thought was useful in understanding the accuracy of the fitted models. So as I mentioned earlier, this is by definition 0. That's because it's the same model. What's interesting is the following. The GOM has a pseudo R squared train between 4.5% to 10.5%. Pseudo R squared validate of between 6.5% and 9.5%. You will see that the GBM has 18.8% pseudo R squared train, 6.3% pseudo R squared validate. And if we overfit the model, hence why I did the 30,000 trees to test, we're going to be explaining a lot about the 6 years, but we're not going to be very good. In fact, we are worse off compared to the traditional model if we overfit the data. I included this to share with everyone because I want to be able to quantify the effect of overfitting. What's really interesting though for me is from this, what is the conclusion? And this is what I found. At first look, the GLMs perform better across train and validate. What I found though is if I had more time to optimize the GBM more, could I have gotten this to 12% and gotten this up to 12%? Potentially, right? I had limited time. I feel like I probably would have been able to. And so I actually think GBM is probably more accurate from an accuracy perspective compared to GLM in this particular data set and certainly in my analysis, provided there's time. But we'll talk about efficiency in a moment. So that's accuracy. And now it's about interpretability, which is the ability for us to explain the model. And so really it comes down to two things. One is, to me, from my learning, is do we need to explain the exact relativities? If we do, a GLM is great. We can produce relativities such as this. And then we can calculate, and we can, you know, if we're asked to go, what is the exact relativity between genders? We can say that. On the flip side, and this is available for GLM, if we do not need to know exact relativities and we only need approximations, then we can think through things like feature importance plot, partial dependency plot, Shapley values, which is the graph on the right there. To give an example, so let's use the top one here. Let's say that's age. Let's say that's age. And the high, if it's blue, then it's high age. If it's yellow, then it's low age. And if it has a negative Shap value, then that means it has a negative influence and vice versa. So for example, this would say that higher age would have lower incidence, for example. Not that this is the case in the data, but that's how we would interpret the graph. But we won't be able to actually get exact relativities. I say that, but that's before I came to the summit, this week. And I went to a presentation on Wednesday on multiplicative Shap. And so maybe actually by the end of next week, my view would have changed. But, you know, this is the way with coming to summit, and this is why we come to learn from each other. But at the moment, though, that, to be fair, the multiplicative Shap paper, it's to the author's credit. It is in developmental stage, so maybe we're getting there. But at this point in time, my view is that if you need exact relativities, you need to have GLM is the way to go. So then lastly is about efficiency. I have a table here. Really, I try to look at it across four things. One is, well, what's the model runtime? And not surprisingly, the traditional analysis fitting only the intercept took a minute. And actually, an actuary probably can do it better, probably can do it in 30 seconds. The GLM took 20 minutes. It might seem long, but actually that goes through all the cross-validation to find the right lambda, etc. So there's a little bit of modeling time required. The GBM took 7 hours. That's not 7 hours to fit one model, and that's because that's 7 hours to do grid search, to search through different hyperparameters to get the most quote-unquote optimal one. Clearly not the most optimal based on the result I showed earlier, but more optimal based on the space that we've searched. It took 7 hours. So there's definitely time difference. But what I think is more important also is the explanation time. I'm very thankful. My boss reviewed the results, and he made me explain to him, as we should, when we get model results. And it is harder. It does take more time to explain the model results through a GBM compared to a GLM, compared to a traditional analysis. You would see there that I put upstream efficiency to be similar. How I define upstream efficiency is if I already have a traditional analysis data set. So imagine all your variables, and then you have a column for expected, you have a column for actuals, your column for exposure, etc. How much more time does it take to actually fit a GLM? How much more time does it take to actually fit a GBM? Historically, I wouldn't say similar, but with the new generative tools now, which of course there's a lot of talk around the industry and certainly at this conference, it's actually quite similar. I wasn't very, very, very familiar with XGBoost. I was able to get an example, implement it, test it out, ask questions, and even ask technical questions. Like, oh, in this case, it was Lasso. So a bit of technical question that I asked as well. I know the Lasso penalty is not differentiable, so how does it actually fit the coefficients, right? Because it's not differentiable, can't use maximum likelihood estimation. Then I learned about coefficient descent, for example. Learned that in half an hour. Would have taken me 4 or 5 hours at a minimum in the past. So upstream efficiency is actually quite similar. Downstream efficiency, though, is something that I was quite fascinated by when I was thinking about this. And I looked at this in three manners. The first one is, okay, what kind of use cases do we have when we fit a model for morbidity or mortality data, right? One of the key use cases is actually downstream assumption software, Prophet, Monet, whatever, right? There are particular structures that needs to be used. Otherwise, there will be additional cost, testing, dev, etc., right? With a GOM, we all are able to create predictive structures, so variable structures that mimic the exact structure of the valuation assumption software. That's very useful because firstly, it allows reconciliation, but also secondly, it means it's easier for people to use. It doesn't take as much time. Business understanding, some would say it's interpretability. I put in efficiency as well because when we model, we always have downstream stakeholders that we need to communicate to. I feel GOMs are generally easier, especially when we ask about relativities, which is very common when I do morbidity or mortality analysis. And lastly, smoothness. And I think the best way to demonstrate smoothness is through some graphs. This is actual data. I've removed the x-axis and y-axis because that's not the point. The point that this is age and this is incidence rate. And I want to demonstrate smoothness. So the green line is an expected basis. The yellow line is the actuals. So a traditional analysis, you will see has decreased because the traditional model was fitted across all the data and I've zoomed into a particular segment to show in this example. So traditional level adjustment. A GOM is very useful in maintaining smoothness when you use things like splines and you use a prior assumption, like an expected basis. So a GOM can look something like this, the purple line. You can see it fits the data better. It retains a level of smoothness. Not perfectly smooth because this is aggregate rates, but actually it's possible to calculate the exact factors and get smooth factors as well. And lastly, the GBM. This is actually a technical learning for me. Even if you fit GBM with splines, it looks like this. And that's because I forgot when I was fitting it, and it was a good reminder that by definition of GBMs, you're cutting it by variables, right? By discrete values. So even if you fit splines, you're going to have a smooth curve, but if you're cutting it into small sections again, you're going to get volatility, essentially. Not volatility, you're going to get, what's the best word? Up and downs. So as you can see then, from a smoothness perspective, I feel GOM is better. So to conclude then, what's my three key learnings and considerations through all that data on morbidity analysis? First is the reconciliation of model. That's a very, very useful explanation to our stakeholders or for our own understanding when something is brought to us. Two, consider whether AVP or AVE is actually a good measure. It's a good check, but is it a good measure of how good the model has fitted? Three, ultimately, it's a trade-off between accuracy versus interpretability and efficiency. I'll now pass to Jin, who will talk about lapse analysis.
Thanks, Tim. Can I have the...
Oh, sorry, yes.
Thanks, Tim, for providing a demonstration of how these models can be applied to a life insurance claims dataset. So I'd be effectively doing the same, but for a lapse dataset. And in particular, I'll be fitting, you know, the same suite of traditional and non-traditional models to this lapse dataset. But I'll be focusing my discussion on properties of these models, including their performance, the interpretability, particularly for actuaries. And I'll also be attaching some of the use cases at the end to some of these models. And just a quick intro on the dataset, as opposed to a real dataset, I've used a public dataset, which I've sourced from IBM. And that's a dataset initially created by IBM to model customer lapses in a telco context. But that's not too dissimilar to a life insurance lapse dataset where you will have your policyholder attributes, almost like a multiple point file where you'll be using to predict a lapse outcome. And I'll be fitting those three models, but, you know, Tim has provided an overview, so I'm not going to repeat them. But these models will be trained on 70% of the randomly chosen data and will be validated against the remaining 30% of the unseen data. And one thing I do want to highlight is that I'll be modeling the labs as a binary prediction problem as opposed to a claims rate problem, which is a regression problem. And the reason for that is I think that, you know, in addition to doing something different for the audience, these kind of prediction may be relevant for use cases such as developing retention campaigns. So you know, you want to know exactly, you know, when the next policy renewal comes up, whether a particular policy holder would lapse or not. So that's to do with a class of 0 and 1. And, okay, so I'm going to get straight into the performance of the model or the accuracy of these models. So the three models will be evaluated using the three metrics in the first column. And just to quickly go over what they are, we have the accuracy, which, as the name implies, measures the overall accuracy of your predictions. But if you have a very imbalanced data set, say, let's say 15% of the data points are lapses, and you just class everything as non-lapse, that would achieve you a 85% accuracy. But, you know, that's at a huge trade-off for your false negatives, and you don't want that. So the accuracy metric is not always the best metric to look at. But it may be more useful when you read it in conjunction with other metrics. And one such metric is the position metric, which measures your accuracy within a particular class, particularly a lapse class. And so out of your predicted lapses, how many have actually lapsed? So it's a more of a targeted measure. Then you will also have the area under the curve, which is a more balanced measure. So, just to explain in a non-technical language, imagine you are using a logistic regression, which is a GLM, to class these data points, and, you class everything, say, above 50% of probability to a lapse class and everything below that to a non-lapse class. You're using a 50% probability threshold. But what AUC does is it kind of measures your trade-offs between your, you know, false positives and false negatives over multiple thresholds. So you can, you know, you can set the threshold to be 60%, 70%, 80%, 90%, so forth. But it gives you more of a balanced view, of your accuracy and the trade-off between position and recall for the techies in this room. But I suppose the overall observation is that, GBM tends to outperform the GLM, for this particular data set anyway, under all three metrics. And, you can see that I've grayed out the baseline GLM, which is the null GLM, team has covered. And that is the GLM fitted with just the intercept term. And that is because that model is not really relevant in a binary prediction problem because it's going to fit, it's going to class everything into just one class. But that's not to say you can't use it. Like if you scale back to a regression problem, that's the model where you will be using to predict your average lapse rate. And, you know, under traditional analysis, if you update your data, you know, every year, you'll get a different average lapse rate and you make your level adjustment that way. Anyway, so the GBM tends to outperform, and I'll try to explain why that's the case, using some visuals in the next few slides. So I've chosen two features from this IBM dataset. They are the monthly charges and the tenure feature. And in a life insurance context, you can think of these as your premiums and your duration in-force, and they're in the Y and X axis respectively. And I've plotted every single observation of these 7,000 policyholders in this IBM dataset. And the red dots represent lapses, and the green dots represent non-lapse or your continuing policyholders. So that's the data, and I've only chosen two features out of 20-ish features because it's harder for me to visualize more than two features on a two-dimensional plane. But if you move to figure two, I've added a few things to this chart. You've got this dashed blue line, which I'm calling it, for the purpose of this talk, the best fit or the best decision boundary that you can derive from any kind of model. And by decision boundary, I mean anything above that, you're going to class into a lapse class. Anything below that to a non-lapse class. And you can think of it as a magic kind of line that you may be able to get from, say, some very complex modeling, such as neural network or ensembling model. But that's the line that I'm going to go with. And in comparison to that line, we have a GLM fit in the, represented by this black line. And you can see that it's quite linear because that's the properties of the GLM. And the decision boundary is usually a function of your two features and some constant. And you can see then that line doesn't really follow the blue dashed line closely. And that's kind of highlighted by these yellow areas, which is really the deficiency of the GLM that I'm trying to show. But what does this look like under a GBM model? So GBM being a non-parametric model, it's going to quite autonomously learn some of the rules that it's going to assign each observation to a particular class. And that's through, you know, permutations of these features. So for these two particular features, I've illustrated this rule in figure 3. And if I were to apply that rule as the decision boundary, that would be that black line in figure 4. And you can see that it's much more aligned to the best fit, which will lead to reduced deficiency. So that's probably my oversimplified way of explaining why the GBM tends to outperform. But just before I get corrected by some of the technical people in the room, there is a way to fit the GLM in such a non-linear way as well, and that is through introducing polynomials of some of the features or some of the very complex interaction terms. So you can kind of achieve that fit as well, but it would take considerable amount of time. As I was mentioning before, under the GBM, it would be quite autonomous. I'm not going to get into the details, but GBM is not really just one single decision tree. Maybe it starts with a single decision tree, but with multiple trees added to that. So, you know, GBM tends to outperform for this particular dataset. Does this mean that we're going to be using the GBM, you know, for all use cases? Obviously, no. And that's to do with the interpretability, of these models. And that's actually the most important, in my view, metric, for an actuary who needs to communicate, you know, your model outputs to various stakeholders. And here on this slide, on the left-hand side, I've shown some of the one example where the model interpretations align. And I've again chosen this tenure feature, which is that duration enforced feature in a life insurance context. And I haven't shown it here, but when fitted to a GLM, your beta coefficient for that feature is negative. You're just going to have to trust me on that. And what that means is, as your tenor or duration increases, your lapse propensity decreases. And that's consistent with this, Shapley value plot, which I think Tim has shown as well for the claims data. So I've boxed in that tenor feature. That's the first feature. And it's color coded. So you can see for low value of tenor, which is this, represented by this kind of teal bluish color, it contributes more to lapses. So that's consistent so far, but there are going to be scenarios or cases or features where you would not be able to use, in my view, as an actuary. And that's on the right-hand side of the slide. I've given a few examples, but I'm going to explain them using some visuals again. So coming back to figure 3. So that's the decision chart or a path that the GBM uses to make a call, right? So for various values of these two features, by following this path in figure 3, it's going to land you in one of the classes. But what if, as an actuary, you know, you want to understand sensitivity to pricing increases. So let's say a policyholder is paying $10 of monthly premium or monthly charges, and you wanted to increase that to $15. And if you follow, figure 3 or that decision path in figure 3, both will land you the same class. So it's not going to really give you a delta. And, that makes it very difficult for an actuary to explain your price elasticity, which sometimes may be important to explain. And another example I'm going to state on this chart is to do with complex interactions. Even though this chart is only showing for two features, like a decision rule for only two features, it's already introducing very complex layers of interaction. So if you recall from Tim's talk, we are able to replicate or reconcile the GBM to a GLM if we were to restrict the length of the tree to just one split, which is that first layer. You know, now with these multiple layers, it's actually adding interactions. And, you know, just visually, you can see that, your monthly charges or different values or different segments of the monthly charges are interacting with different segments of your tenor, which makes it very hard for an actuary to explain just by looking at this decision tree. Whereas under GLM, it's much more comprehensive because you can probably do it using a function of the beta coefficients. Lastly, I just wanted to attach some of the use cases, or example use cases. But overall, it falls under this framework that Tim has proposed, which is to do with your accuracy or performance, interpretability, and efficiency. So I think my view is that if you have a preference for these two columns, for interpretability or performance, that kind of drives your model choice. And you can see that for use cases where you would prefer interpretability over performance, you would use the GLM and GBM otherwise. And just very quickly, because I'm running out of time, if you wanted to if you're doing experience studies and you wanted to have way greater control of your features and narratives, obviously you would opt for GLM because you need to explain to your internal stakeholders or external auditors, for example, what you're doing. But there are going to be times where the performance may be more important. So if you're, say, developing a retention campaign and an uplift in your position in a 7,000 strong data set, it's going to help you potentially retain 70 more policyholders. It kind of brings commercial value, and which makes it more acceptable to use the GBM at the expense of maybe a little bit loss of interpretability. And there's that overarching consideration with efficiency. So just to wrap up our talk, there is obviously no single best model, and we did not advocate for a single best model. But we recommend that we follow a framework which involves three metrics when we choose a model. And that and the preference for these metrics are guided by your business context. And just last thing that I wanted to highlight, there are ways to, say, use the outputs of both models. I think the IFOA has published an article on that. And now I'm going to hand back to Samin for Q&A.
Thank you, Jing. Yeah, I think we got a few questions coming in. The first one from Tianxuan Chu. Hi, Jing. Sometimes lapse data is subject to large policy lapse. What is your recommendation of how to treat them? Assume we model dollar lapse.
Thanks. Could you... Subject to large policy lapse, what is your recommendation of how to treat them? So I take it that this is to do with large sum insured. I think you can overlay, this is my view, you can overlay your lapse modeling with some kind of commercial model. So that's like a lifetime value model or your embedded value method. So you have the propensity to lapse. But if you also attach to each policy a commercial value, like your embedded value, you can design your retention campaign that way, I think, which may help you prioritize some of the policyholders over others. Not sure if it answers the question.
I'm not the person to ask the question, but I'd like to suggest two solutions to that question. One is that the sum insured or whatever value you're attaching can be one of the predictors. The other is you can have a weighted model where you weight via the value. I've done both in the past. The concern of the question, I'm assuming, is that it's not necessarily that you need an unbiased estimate at the count level. It does matter that you have an unbiased estimate at the dollar level.
Cool. Thank you, Colin. So next question is actually from Colin himself. And who are the...
I spammed you on this app. please read the positive thing first before
I... Oh, yeah. So, Colin is highly recommend... He's saying some good words about having some rigorous analytics in the life insurance industry. I think, I discussed with Colin 6 months ago on, how I want to move into this area as well. Yeah. So question from Colin, who are the stakeholders you are explaining the models to? Is it old, obsolete actuaries, or sales marketing people or auditors? Is the focus of explainability on common sense or immaterial details?
I'll take that. If I say that's a really good question, that's not to offend anyone, just to be clear. But it is actually a really good question. And then we have different stakeholders with different types of experience, different types of knowledge. So the question is, top one, right? What are these stakeholders I'm explaining? In my experience, for morbidity, mortality analysis, I explain to the valuation actuaries and the pricing actuaries. And they're quite different, right? Valuation actuaries are quite focused on getting the portfolio level right because of reserving. They're also very concerned about how much time it's going to take to implement the assumptions. Fair enough. So utilizing the approach of GLM, for me, from my experience, works really, really well. For pricing actuary, it could be different. They have more flexibility. They want to be able to explain to further stakeholders more. So not my direct stakeholders, but their stakeholders could be a client. In that case, the exact relativities and actually explainability, having shown the exploratory analysis, is also important. Now, when I take it to my claims assessors, which I use, because I model termination analysis and I try to help them do claims, quote-unquote, triaging or prioritization, I try to skip all the details and just find examples. So then actually, for those stakeholders, from my experience, it's about me explaining to myself that it could be understood. Actually, with generative AI now, I try to use generative AI as a tool to see if I'm explaining it in a way that is easier to understand, because they specialize in claims management and not necessarily statistics. And so that's my experience. Jin, do you have anything to add?
Okay, so we only got a few minutes left. Let's go quickly through different questions. Next one is from Jared Spawart. Is life insurance behind other industries? If we place such high emphasis on interpretability, do we need to do a better job of either educating our stakeholders or convincing stakeholders to trust us?
If you want to answer, but you want to ask us.
Just very quickly, I think that's a good question. Thanks, Jared. I think just talking to some of the GI actuaries, I think some of them actually help review this work. I think GLM is still very prevalent in GI, and I think they, use some of the more non-traditional modeling because they have more data. But in life insurance space, I think it's worth exploring different suite of the modeling techniques. It's still the problem context that's going to drive the use case and the modeling. And I think some of the stakeholders, based on my experience, don't really care what model that you've used anyway. So it's more to like whether you have a sensible narrative that people believe in and buy. And I think what we've discussed here is if we wanted to have greater control, for example, like for a lab analysis anyway, we should, that should drive the choice of the model maybe to some extent.
If I may add as well, to directly answer the question, I don't think we're that far behind. One of the papers that I use that I use a lot is the CAS Monograph 13 on lesser credibility, CAS being the Casualty Actuarial Society, what they produced last year. It's something that I use a lot in terms of what they advocate in that paper, and I've been using for the last 2-3 years before the paper was generated. What I didn't know is that actually we are actually on a very similar pathway with the general insurance actuaries in lines where the data quantity is actually quite similar. So, for example, commercial lines. So we're not that far behind. It's the direct answer to that. That's why we're doing this presentation. We just need to try to explain more, share more, and learn more.
Okay. Next, we've got a comment from Greg Taylor. Efficiency perhaps measured not in hours, but dollars of skilled personnel. Another question from Iris Dunn. I'm a big fan of neural network. Could you explain when should we use neural networks?
If you're using Gen AI, you're already using neural networks. Right. So it's not so much about comparing different neural networks to this. I will get there, but I think it's my question at the moment is if I'm explaining to stakeholders, they will ask me, how does the GBM compare to a neural network? I don't have that answer yet. So I need to go and explore that, in my opinion, and then I'll slowly get there. Jin, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just quickly to add to that, I think neural network actually again depends on the number of data points to perform. You know, like in a kind of an image based world, if each pixel is a data point, and you have a million maybe for each image, and not to mention videos, but for kind of a live instance claims, it's very hard to shouldn't say that, but sometimes it's hard to dice. And also I think we need to separate the signal from the hype. So AI is a hype, neural network it's a buzzword. It's really just a combination of linear modeling with an activation function that's nonlinear.
Yeah, we're at time. Yeah. Thank you everyone for attending today's session.